everyone. I'm Buddy, I'm an alcoholic. They got me on the stool up here, so I look pretty tall. But I thank Larry for inviting me to come down here. I came here, first to back off, I'm Buddy H from San Diego, not Buddy M. I don't know where that came from. But it was like, cool, it's not me, I'm out of here. And I just moved here, so I had him introduce me as from San Diego, because I moved here 2 years ago from Arizona, and I didn't want you all to go, ooh, zonies, and start throwing crap at us, and chase out the door. So anyway, I came here a couple weeks ago. I love to do service work, and I was on a committee that we do a roundup of conventions, the largest English-speaking convention in Mexico. And I came down, I asked Larry to give me some names of the speakers, and I got his and a couple of others sent to the committee to see if they could select a speaker to go down to Mexico and speak for us down there. And Larry said, yeah, I'll give you some names. And he goes, how long have you been sober? And I told him, and he said, yeah, have you spoke here yet? And I said, no. He goes, well, good. And how about that? Yeah, so here I am. And I get nervous, not real fond of doing this stuff. My sobriety date is October 28th, 1988. So I've been around for a little bit, and been having a good time. And they tell us how the big books share in a general way what it used to be like, you know, what happened, what it's like now. So that's what I'm going to try to do for you tonight, and hopefully I'm not too boring. Or I would like to get up here and tell you how cool and awesome I used to be, but you'll just probably figure out after a little bit what an idiot I used to be. And I wasn't a real bright kid. And like I said, I grew up in Arizona. I was born in a town called Apache Junction, Arizona. I don't know if any of you have ever been there. It's at the base of the Superstition Mountains. I think it's a beautiful place. It is in the middle of the desert, and it's real hot. But when I grew up there, it was a little bitty redneck town. And I mean, when I say redneck, it was redneck. If we drove to a town the size of Santee, we were in the city. You know, it was redneck. And I got my first firearm when I was 9 years old. And and we carried them to school, you know. And we weren't allowed to take the loaded ones into class, but we did have them there. For the most part, I thought my life, my childhood was really normal. I did grow up a redneck. I had redneck parents. My mom's from a little bitty town in southern Texas. And, I mean, really made our town look like a big city. So, I mean, she was from a real small town. Grew up there during the Depression and World War II. And I mentioned this because I just want to mention the family history of alcoholism. Her dad hung himself when she was 18 years old because he was a German during the World War II. They were persecuting him, and he didn't want the government to get his money, so instead of giving up his money, he hung himself. And drunk, of course. And my dad's dad died at 56 from alcohol-related diseases. And so, you know, got members of my family early, and mom and dad were heavy drinkers. I don't know if they're alcoholic. They're functioning alcoholics, I guess, if anything. I grew up in the American Legions. I don't know if any of you are familiar with those. Dad is at military, and matter of fact, everyone pretty much I know drank and was in the military. And that's pretty much what I grew up with. And Fridays and Saturday nights were at the American Legion. I was hustling, pulling, sneaking the leftover drinks off the table by the time I was 12 years old. You know, me and my sister, that's where we was at. And we thought that was normal, you know. And for us, it was normal. I don't want to make it sound bad, because I enjoyed my childhood. My parents weren't abusive. They didn't neglect us. We're always taken care of. But they didn't show us how to drink like men and women, that's for sure. You know, we drank for effect. They drank for effect. And as soon as we started drinking, I started drinking on a daily basis or a weekend basis or whatever, probably middle teen years. I'm not sure exactly when, but what helped with that, too, is my dad was a club committee chairman, they called it, for the American Legion. So he had his name on the liquor license for all the American Legions in the whole state of Arizona. So we'd travel around from Arizona and do all the Legion bars, and Dad would do little inspections on the Legion. But every time he went and did an inspection, he comes out the back door with a bottle of case of Jim Beam or, you know, whatever, you know. So I talked to friends, you know, when they were growing up, or even some of you guys in here, and they talk about sneaking out of Mom and Dad's booze and alcohol, and they'd get a little bit of this, a little bit of that. Well, we'd just take whole bottles, man, or cases, and go out to the desert, you know. And we had a supply of alcohol. We had a full stock bar in the house. I mean, fully stocked bar. And so we could drink, and we did. And I have four brothers and a sister. My four brothers are quite a bit older. I mean, me and my sister are the big oops, you know. My brothers are all Vietnam era vets. And my youngest brother, closest to my age, is 8.5, 9 years older than me. So we've got there's a generation gap. And I was a little bitty guy trying to compete in their world, and it was hard to do. So I got into alcohol and other substances at an early age to try to compete with my brothers. I remember the first incidents that I tried to compete with them is when my brother James raced dirt bikes, and he got home and he's out of Vietnam and he's racing dirt bikes. He's back home living with Mom and Dad, and he had this big toolbox over in the corner of the bedroom, and he kept his weed on the top of the toolbox. And Dad went in there to get a screwdriver. I don't mean to talk about drugs. This is part of my story, though. Dad went in there and got to get a screwdriver or something, found James's weed, and blows his top. And this is from the early 70s, and he's screaming and yelling, and James, he looks at me, I walk by, and he goes, "Go throw this away." And I'm like, "Yeah, okay." So I walk out to you used to have the old galvanized garbage cans out on the curb, and I walked out and picked up the lid and dropped it behind the can so he couldn't see it, and put the lid down, and waited until he went to bed and went and got it out, and gave it back to my brother, you know, and it was an end. Now I'm in. I'm not the little geeky kid anymore. I'm not the nerd, you know, but he's growing up. He's cool. And at least that's what I thought. And it's funny that because that brother James is years later, when I really got into drinking and I developed a problem, none of them developed the problem that I did and became alcoholics. And they were doing a family intervention, and my mom's crying, going, "Whose fault is this?" And my brother James goes, and as we know, it's not his fault. It's in me, you know. It's just there. And but now, you know, like I said, a lot of teenage years running around in Apache Junction. We didn't get in a lot of trouble out there. We didn't have a lot of consequences. I was talking to my wife about this earlier, that was one of my things about my drinking. I drank hard and partied hard and did a lot of stuff, but I didn't have any consequences. Grew up in the 70s in that little bitty town where everybody knew us, and the cops pull you over, they just took you home. You know, they took your weed or they took your booze, and they took you home. They'd let you drive home. I remember I got pulled over on the side of the road, and I was leaning on the door of the car, and the cop pulled me over, and I fell out onto the road. And he picked me up, and he said, "Where are you going?" I said, "I'm going home." And this one was going to take me because I'm going to take him to jail. And my neighbor was a judge, and I said, and we called it. His name was Corwin Brundrett, and I said, "Oh, my Uncle Corwin's going to kill him," because that's what we called him, Uncle Corwin. I've known him since I was two. And he goes, "Judge is your uncle?" And I go, "Yeah." And he goes, "I'll follow you home." And that was my life. You know, I could get out of trouble. It was a small town, and we just stayed out of trouble. And I don't know how. And like I said, it was the 70s. And I've talked to other people, and that's the way it was. Different than it is now. Now you get busted, the consequences are serious. Back then, they took your crap away and sent you home. And wrote your name down, you know, and slapped your hand. And let's see what I'm about 18 years old, not about 18 years old, 6 days after I was 18 years old, six days after I turned 18, my first daughter was born. Started a couple of things younger. I ended up having five children pretty quick, and finally figured out what it was. It was something near. It was her legs. But, Sorry about that. So anyway, I found out a couple things I did good. Drink and have children, you know, and But in 1980, when your girlfriend was pregnant, what you do? You got married and you joined the Air Force, or you joined the Air Force and you get married, whichever order you want to look at it. You know, that's what I did. I joined the Air Force, and that's where I thought I could grow up. You know, I thought I could get away from the drugs and the alcohol. You don't get away from the alcohol in the military, I found out. So, which I didn't. I joined the Air Force to see the world. I was raised in Apache Junction, Arizona. My first duty station, Davis-Monthan, Tucson, Arizona. 80 miles away, you know. Whole bunch of new type of cactus down there or something. But, let's see. I stayed there and, started... Back then, even though I wasn't 21 yet, the drinking age back then was 18. Then it turned to 19, and then it turned to 21 in Arizona. But because I was already those ages, I was grandfathered in. I could drink, you know. So I was drinking legally in the bars at 18. And we drank and we partied and drank and partied in the military. And I put in for worldwide duty. The Air Force loved that, and they sent me, my wife, and at this time two babies to Germany. And we went over there, and not taking her inventory, but she was one of us. Alcoholic family. I used to go with her stepfather and her mom down to Mexico, and we used to bring duffel bags of weed across the border before I went in the military at 16 years old, you know. So they're definitely some of us, you know. And I thought that was cool, by the way. You know, I thought I was having a good time and invincible. A little spooky. Anyways, I put in for worldwide duty, and they sent me to Spengdalen Air Force Base, Germany. And went over there and found German beer and fell in love. It was a great place, man. And the wife did, too. We both just drank and partied. And we started, had our third kid, and I started going, getting tired of staying home with kids and wife, and I got the Air Force to send me on temporary deployments, TDYs, and they'd send me to Spain and England and France, and they even sent us back to Vegas one time, and sent me in all over the place for 30 days at a time, and the wife and the kid would stay, or kids were staying home, and that marriage quickly went south because of the separation and the drinking alcohol. And people used to ask me what had happened, and I told them it was our great sex life. It was, just wasn't with each other, you know. And that's pretty much what it was. And it was me. I'll take ownership of my side, and it was her too, you know. And that's the way it went. Our marriage went bad, and she took the kids, went to Germany, or came back to Arizona. I went to Spain for a year and a half, 18 months over there, drank and partied over there, and once again stayed out of trouble. Right before I went, when I was going from the two quick Air Force stories, this pattern of no consequences continued for me, even the military. The military looked after me over there, and I stayed out of trouble. One of the times when it was Labor Day, 4th of July, Memorial Day, I don't know, some holiday, and they came around a roll call and told us, if you're out drinking tonight and you need a ride back to the barracks, stop an MP and they'll either get you a base taxi or they'll give you a ride back to the barracks. And we're like, oh, that's cool. So the only thing was, this is for people who were partying at the NCO club or the Airman's club and lived on base. Well, I didn't live on base, and I didn't party on base. So I drove back from the bar off base to the front gate of the military post and started arguing with the MPs that they had to give me a ride home. They didn't. I spent the next 90 days painting rocks white, but I didn't get in any trouble. I mean, that was it. I mean, that was a slap in the hand. That was just, it was work, but that was no big deal. I wasn't in trouble. And then right before they threw me a short times party between Spain and Germany. I was going to Spain and I rented this taxi cab, this rental car, and was going to drive to Spain from Germany. Thought it'd be pretty cool, and it would have been pretty cool, but I never made the trip. But I went to the short timers party, and all my GI friends, they had, you know those glass boots that the Germans drink out of, like this big? They gave me a set of them, a pair of them, full of beer, and said, if you drink them, you get to keep the boots. So I did, and they poured me in my car afterwards. I don't remember getting in the car. I woke up in the back of in Germany there's a law, if you refuse blood alcohol, they're allowed to take it by force on the side of the road. They keep the kids, they do blood alcohol on the side of the road, and I don't think I refused them. I don't know. I just woke up in the back of their car. And I was pretty covered in blood. They took me to the base, and I went to the brig for the night and to the cop shack. And the next day, my first sergeant came, brought me down, brought me a clean uniform. Told me I had to go, and we had a full bird colonel for a commander. And he's like, you're going to go down, you're going to go see the old man. I'm thinking, man, I'm in trouble, you know. I had no idea what happened. I knew I wrecked the car. I was covered in blood. And I woke up in jail, and I was like, this isn't good. And I go in front of this first sergeant and this full bird colonel, and they're sitting there. And all of a sudden, they start laughing. I'm thinking, this isn't that funny to me, you know. In Germany, there's a law. I guess some weird laws in Germany. You hit a chicken, you got to like pay for its eggs for like the next 20 years. I mean, I'm serious. I'm dead serious. They got these weird ass laws over there. But this law worked out in my benefit. What caused my car to go in a car accident is I skidded through cow manure. And the cow, or the dairy farmer who raked his cattle up and down the street to the dairy farm, was required by law to wash the manure off the street. And he didn't do it. That caused the wreck. It wasn't my drinking. You know, I knew it. Yeah. And that first sergeant and full bird colonel escorted a sergeant off the base and said, don't ever come back. You know, and he said, get out of here. Get to Spain and get out of here before we change our mind. I went to Spain. Ex-wife was back. Wasn't the ex-wife. Wife, but she was playing ex-wife, and I was playing ex-husband. You know, she was back in Arizona, and not much happened in Spain, just a lot of drinking and partying. And I got stationed in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. Got there, and I started calling the ex-wife, you know, doing this drunk calls at 2 o'clock in the morning, and she'd call back. And we did that for a while until I went back to Arizona and said, come on, we can do this again. And bring the kids out and let's do this again. And I went back to South Carolina, and she followed a month later and did just like I promised, said, here's your kids, see you later. Now I'm down in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, a drunk with three little girls. The youngest one was two. She was still wearing diapers. The oldest one was five. And I had no living skills. You know, the only skill I had is what the military showed me. I did my job in the military very well. But that's it. You know, I had no living skills, no functioning skills. I did not have any parenting skills. I moved up on I had to get on a list to get into base housing. So I got on a list, and they moved me up because of my situation. So me and the kids could be on base where it's easier to get daycare and stuff, which just meant I didn't have to pay rent, so I had more money to party, and we had a place to do it at. So, the kids got fed, and so the kids weren't getting. I don't want you to think I was running around beating the heck out of the kids or anything. That didn't happen until years later. Huh? I'm just kidding. So but here I was, a single parent. I got these three little girls, and this one usually gets me booze from the women in the crowd. The little girls were, like I said, two, three, and five. And they had blonde hair that they could get under their knees or sit on, at least, all of them. Just beautiful blue eyes, gorgeous little girls. And I'm a guy, man. I can't fix girls' hair. I took them to the base barbershop, and all their hair cut this short. See? I bought them all blue overalls or shorts and t-shirts, man. And I used to have people go, man, those are some cute little boys. And I said, thank you. And don't worry, I've made amends to those girls, you know. And anyway, I did party and stuff down there, and partying started changing now, though. I no longer could go to the bar and hang out with my friends and go chasing girls. I was trying to be responsible, but, you know, this is when I started drinking more for a fact, just to get drunk, just to hide those feelings of inadequacy and fear and all that crap. You know, I started drinking at home and drinking alone and drinking it by myself, you know, wait till the kids go to bed and start drinking then. And occasionally we'd have friends over and we'd play poker after the kids and stuff went to bed, but the partying days were going away. And I had just re-enlisted right before that, because the wife was going to get there. We're going to make a career out of the Air Force and all that crap. So I just re-enlisted for my third term. And Now all of a sudden I'm a single parent. She took off, had no idea where she was, and I went to my commander and was able to get my reenlistment mixed and come back to Arizona and be a dad, and that was the right thing to do. And I was trying to save some money, so we're going to save some money instead of flying back from South Carolina. Didn't have a car, and because of that rolling the car incident in Germany, I wasn't allowed to drive on any military installation ever again. I forgot to mention that part. So no need to have a car, right, when you live on a military installation. Then, let me see. I was saving some money. I decided I'm going to take these three kids, and we're going to get on a bus to Arizona from Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. That's coast to coast. That's 3,700 miles in a Greyhound with three girls and me. And I'm a drunk. And we got to Atlanta, Georgia, which is like the first stop. It's not that bad. We get there, and I'm so scared of just something going to happen to these girls now. For some reason, I just went into this total fear of these kids. You know, I got to do for these kids. And, my parents were good parents, and I wanted to do that for them, you know, be a good parent. And I wasn't up to this point, so I wanted to really try. And I got to Atlanta, Georgia, and my oldest one, she was my helper, you know, she's seven, and she's like, they all had to go to the bathroom. I'm like, can you take your sisters in there? I'm going to wait right here by the door. And you guys have been to bus stations. It's not the best crowd of people in the world, you know, so I'm a little nervous. And this kid's going to the bus station. I'm like, watch my time. 5 minutes, 10 minutes. They're not out. I'm getting a little nervous. Finally, some lady comes in. I was like, I've got three little girls in there. Can you go check on them? And she goes in, comes out, goes, there's no kids in here. And my heart sank. And I ran through this woman's bathroom, and on the other side, as soon as you run through, there's another side on the other side that says exit. And I just, paranoid, I ran out the door, and there's all three of them just bawling their eyes out. Daddy left us at the bus station. But anyway, we got on the bus, came back, got to Arizona. Things just started, from there went downhill, and I mean really quick. I didn't think they were going downhill until I got to that point, and then I knew they were in a... I started drinking real hard. The kids ended up, I'm going to get out of this real quick. And the kids ended up going back with their mom for a little bit. And I went into drinking hard, real hard, and other substances. And I got to the point where I was sticking needles in my arms and doing whatever I needed to get what I needed to do. And it got bad. I mean, it got really, really ugly for me for a little bit. And I do say a little bit, because from the time I got out of that service to the time I got sober was only 2 years. But that was a long freaking 2 years, I hate to say, you know. Or if you guys have been there, I don't have to tell you, you know. Back at that time, I went back up way back into junior high school. I met this kid there, John Galloway. He ended up being my best friend. We drank all those 3 years. We went all those years of high school and stuff. Every story I've told you through high school and stuff, and part of the ones in the military, he was there. He was one of us. Well, about 2 years, right before I got out of the service, he got out 2 years before I did. And right before then, before I got out, his dad got a DUI. His dad got a DUI and got court ordered to go to AA. And lost his license. So his dad, we called him Big John. His son, we call him Little John. So I don't have some dad-son thing anymore. So Big John's going to AA. Little John's driving him and smoking pot in the parking lot while his dad's in the meeting. And one day he gets cotton mouth and goes into the meeting to see how his dad's doing, and AA catches him. And he's been here ever since, so he's got 24 years of sobriety now. And he got sober with a group of guys, and they were sober bikers. And I rode, got my first Harley when I was 17 years old and was riding all Harleys all that time, too. And I rode, and he would come by my house and go, "Want to go for a motorcycle ride?" And he was in a sober motorcycle club. He was the president of a sober motorcycle club. And I'd go, "You want to go riding?" And I'd go, "Yeah, I'd love to go riding." And get sober. And they'd all take off. And he did this for a while. And I used to sit in bars and tell him, brag about him. "Man, my friend John, you should have seen how this guy drank. And now he's sober, man. It's so cool." I'd brag about him. I didn't think I had a problem, but, you know, it's so cool that John got sober. And anyway, let's speed up real quick. Sitting there, I had all the family interventions, all that crap, you know, that we all have had. And one night I'm sitting in this bar, it's my bar, and my brother comes into this bar, and it's the brother I was telling you about before that I hid the pot for. And He comes in, and he's had done an intervention before, but this time it was different. He came in, he said, buddy, I don't know if you got a problem or what your deal is. He goes, if you need help, if you want to go to treatment, whatever you need. He goes, I was unemployed at the time. And he said, he goes, I'll pay for it, whatever, whatever you need. He goes, I'm not here. He goes, I'm not judging you. I'm not asking you. He goes, if you think you do, let me know. And then he left. And it really ruined my buzz, you know. And he left. I denied it. And then it got worse. I walked outside, and I'm going home. There's these balloons that someone released, and they're out in this field. And on the balloons are these white cards. And on the cards it says, "Does drugs and alcohol have a hold of your life?" And it was for a freaking treatment center. But I picked up on those cards, and I bawled like a baby. You know, they talk about the spiritual experience. That, for me, was my burning bush. I cried like a baby. I went home, and I called John. You know, and that was October 27th, 1988. The next day, I got sober. And I've been sober ever since. Knock on wood, you know. I've only had to do this one time. And John didn't take me to an AA meeting. He picked me up. He said, okay, I'll come pick you up in the morning. He goes, get rid of what... Actually, said, I'll come pick you up now, and did. He got rid of everything in my house, and he came and picked me up. Threw a couple of t-shirts and some jeans in a bag. He goes, we're going camping. And I go up there, and it's all these bikers. And I've seen some sober riders come in here earlier. It's and you guys might have heard of it. It's a club called the Fifth Chapter. I used to run around. And the Fifth Chapter picked me up and took me to this cabin up in the woods and let me dry out. And the only thing I remember about that whole weekend, to be honest with you, I don't remember anything. Anyone talking about AA or sponsorship or a big book or any of that shit. I just remember this one guy sitting across the meeting, and I'm just running my mouth. And he's just laughing at me, nodding his head. And that's all I remember, you know. And he's actually a very good friend of mine now. So I started hanging out with these guys, this Fifth Chapter guys, and I got sober. And you know, they introduced me to the big book. They introduced me to AA and sponsorship. And in that club, some people can say some really bad things about them, because they did some really bad things too. They weren't the best guys in the world. Still, they weren't living a good, what I look back at now as a good, clean, sober life. They were clean and sober, but you know, you guys maybe know what I'm talking about. But anyway, there were some good guys, but they were doing some bad things still, some of them. And I'm not going to take any more of that inventory. But anyway, they did introduce me. To be in the club, you had to have an AA sponsor, and you had to have a sponsor in the club. So they got me this big old ZZ Top-looking dude, man. I mean, swear to God, Jeff Giffords is his name. And he's got his master's degree in drug and alcohol psychology, whatever. But he's got a beard down to here, and just a big old guy, tattooed, and he was tough. You know, he used to just tell me to sit down, shut up. You know, and I mean, he was serious about it. And we'd get down, and we got on our knees and prayed, and all that stuff. And you know, it changed my life. And I'm back up a little bit. That wasn't, that sounded like it happened real quick, right into the first 2 years into AA. I wasn't doing that. The first 2 years, I still had records from the past I didn't clean up, and went to jail 4 times in sobriety. Every time I'd get out. They're all weekend stuff. One was like 90 days. But there's records of the past, and I'd get out and be out for a couple of days and back in again. And the last time I was in, this guy from another motorcycle club, a non-sober motorcycle, I had on something to do with AA, a shirt, a hat, or something. And some other guy from a 1%er club in Arizona came up and pulled a big book off of a rack in the reading in the jail, Prescott County Jail, and handed me this big book. Said, start reading it. And I didn't read much, and I can't tell you what I read, but I read enough to know that I needed to start getting serious, started really changing my life. And even though I wasn't drinking, I wasn't living sober. You know, is that, what do they call that? That dry drunk. And I also had gotten remarried in that time. And back up a little more again, when I got sober, I didn't know where my kids were. Sort of knew where they were, but not positive. And I started praying about it from day one in sobriety. About for 30 days, my prayers were answered, and someone told me, this is where your kids are. And I went over there, and the house they were in, there was rigs on the table, and it was a bad place for children to be, but thank God nothing had ever happened to those kids. I got those kids back then, and they were 7, 5, and 4, and now they are 27, 25, and 24. Oh, yeah. Ooh, yeah, 29. Damn it, that makes me older. Yeah, my oldest daughter is going to be 30 next year. That sucks. And I have 4 grandchildren, and they're the joy of my life. You know, I raised those girls in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was telling someone this the other day where I came home one day, and I got the 5 girls, or 4 girls and their brother, and they're in the bedroom. And I hear them in there, and they got a stack of books up, and they got their fake podium, and they're playing AA meeting in the books when they're little kids, you know? And if you took them to church and they prayed at the end of church, you know, said a prayer out loud, they'd always yell out, "Keep coming back." And the preacher or whatever would go, "That's right." So, but they're the joy of my life. You know, that was me and my wife moved out here to San Diego 2 years ago, and they're all in Arizona, all my kids and grandkids and stuff. And that's the hardest part about it, you know, for me. Siri, my wife here, we've been married for 3 years. We met on March 5th, and we got married on March 10th, 2 years later.
Yeah.
Those are my grandkids and stuff, so she doesn't have a little bit of hard time understanding. She doesn't have kids of her own. They're like, "Why do you want to go back there? It's 150 and something. My babies are there, you know?" And they're my kids. They brought me through a lot, you know? And anyways, after about 4 years of sobriety, that's when I really got serious. I had the sponsor. He got me doing the steps and making my amends and did all the steps. And he also was starting to ask me. At this time, I was working construction jobs. I worked at the middle of the night making bagels and it was whatever. I didn't have a career. I didn't know what I was going to be when I grew up. And that's what he started asking. "What are you going to be? When are you going to grow up?" I said, "Well, I always wanted to be an engineer." He goes, "Well, go be an engineer." I said, "No, you got to go to college for that." He goes, "Well, go to college." I said, "I can't go to college, man. I'm trying to get sober. I got 5 kids. I got to work with them." He goes, "So what?" He goes, "It may take you longer than other people. Go do it." You know, and he got me enrolled, and I went to MCC and got a bunch of prerequisites done at Mesa Community College. And then I ended up going to ASU, and it took me 6 years to get a 4-year degree. You know, when I 8 years to get a 4-year degree, but I did it, and I did that raising 5 kids. Working full time and working stuff. I also kept my AA commitments there. He said, "You also got to keep your commitments. Can't forget about those." And I did the GSR stuff. And I did, you know, meeting level commitments and committee level commitments and service work to me. You know, for me, that's where it gives back. I've never sponsored a lot of people. I've sponsored a couple of people, and it's not because I'm not willing to. It just hasn't arrived. But, man, I love service work. I love getting out and doing something. I haven't got real bald since I've been here in San Diego, but you guys start seeing me around because it keeps me sober. It's keeping involved. It's just picking up chairs and stacking them after the meeting or being a greeter or being, for grace of the God, come up here and do something like this. You know, how fantastic is this? I hate doing it, but when I get done, I always go home and sleep like a baby. You know, I feel good. And I got to be, one of the biggest joys I had is I got to be on a committee member. And I started, it's a 5-year commitment. And to this roundup, I started talking about it at the beginning, down in Rocky Point, Mexico. And this is at this, they have it at these condos on the beach, on the Sea of Cortez, and it's a big horseshoe shaped. And they have the meetings out in the horseshoe. And you look at the Sea of Cortez, and they have dances out there and speakers. We've had, you know, some great, fantastic speakers down there. I got to do that for 5 years, and I got to chair that. And it was one of the, you know, best things and ever happened to me. The gifts that AA has given back to me, you know, that gratitude list, I could just go on and on and on. And it hasn't all been good, you know. I got married when I first got back to, before Siri here, there's one in between, okay? And I met a girl when I got, I had 30 days sober, she had a day sober, and a year later we were married. And you know what? They say don't get involved in your first year, but we were married for 13 years. And it was a successful marriage. It just didn't end successfully. So. And it was a good relationship, and we had a kid together, and we were cordial on the phone. It ended amicably. It just, you know, it came to an end. And I forgot where I was going with that. I hate my hand. Anyways, that happened, and so it was a bad, you know, that was a good thing. That's what it was, good and bad, you know. It was a good thing I met that lady, had a good marriage. It was a bad thing when I got divorced, but it turned out to be a good thing. So I met Siri, you know, and I buried my mother in sobriety. I buried a son in sobriety. You know, it's a good thing. I buried a lot of friends. If you guys are new to this program and you hang around a lot of us, you will bury some of us, and it's sad. It sort of keeps me sober in a way, you know. I had lots of fun, too. Motorcycle rides, been to Sturgis sober, and I've been to the Serenity Run up in Colorado sober. Last week, Siri and I and Jeff went to Flagstaff, Arizona. About 1,800 sober people camping in the woods, man, and it was a blast. And World Convention coming up. Today, the Unity Parade, or Parade. I keep saying Parade. Unity Day Picnic, we had a good time. We rode a bicycle out there and sat in the sun, ate some hot dogs, watched the skits. We didn't get to stay for the speakers, but we had a good time. I mean, they say don't leave 5 minutes before the miracle, and those first 2 years, first two years when I was just living dry and not sober was rough, and I almost gave up, and I'm so glad I didn't, because the gifts are just, they just keep going and going. Even this place, I'll just finish with this, how we got here to San Diego. Siri lived here 6 years, and she kept telling me, and she was out in Arizona, and she kept telling me, you got to move me to back to Southern California. And so I said, I'm going to move back to Southern California. My kids all live here. I'm staying here. You know, I'm in Arizona. I'm a zony. I love it. And I do. I love Arizona. You'll never get me to say a bad word about it. And I was at work one day, and just had this new job. Been there about a year and a half, and going to work, and got a great review on Tuesday and a nice raise. And on Friday, they laid me off. But they gave me the review because they wanted me to know that this is what he told me, and I believe him. He's a real nice guy. That he wanted me to know I was getting laid off just because there was a reduction in force, not because of my work abilities or ethics or anything like that. And he said, you're going to get 4 more weeks working, and you're going to get 6 weeks severance pay, and sorry, but that's it. Maybe something changed that time, but it's not looking good. And I said, okay. Well, I went home and told her, and we both prayed about it, and we both said, you know, how do we know this isn't the best thing that could ever happen to us? And Monday, I go to work. I haven't looked for a job yet. That day, I was going to start getting my resume together and stuff. I hadn't at this point. And from an old resume I put out 10 years ago, I get this phone call. It's a guy at Solar Turbines in Kearney Mesa. Say, you look for work? I said, yeah, I am. You want to come to San Diego? I said, yes, I do. And we talked on the phone for a few minutes. He said, I'll have an offer letter to you by Wednesday. I went home and told her, how bad do you really want to go to San Diego? And she goes, bad, why? I said, we're moving next Monday. You know, and here we are. And you know what? Like I said, this has been a gift. It's you hear the saying, the grace of God go I. And my sponsor had me look this up early in my life, and it was the word grace. And the grace is an undeserved divine gift. And that's what this has been for me, is an undeserved. I didn't do anything to deserve to be here. As a matter of fact, I did everything to deserve to not be in here, be in prison, or to be any place else up here in front of you guys, you know. I want to thank you guys for having me. Great. Thanks.